much, Margaret. I'm very pleased to be here this afternoon and contribute to the seminar series, and look forward to hearing your views and thoughts and reflections at this time when there's a lot of the questions that I'm going to talk about today very much part of a public conversation happening on this island and around these islands as well. Just as an introduction, recently last Wednesday launched this report in the European Parliament in Brussels on the European Union and Irish unity with a local barrister, Mark Bassett, exploring the role of the European Union in the debate that I'm going to be looking at and talking about today and I'll return to. In terms of the title for the talk, it's, I suppose, Brexit and other things to discuss today. Shared Island, Brexit and Constitutional Futures. Very much part of work that I've been doing with others this year around the constitutional conversations that are emerging and being accelerated as a result of Brexit. In doing that and thinking about the title, I'm very conscious that those constitutional and other discussions are rightly framed in relation to these islands. But what I want to do today is focus specifically on this island, but with a full recognition that what I'm talking about has wider implications for these islands as well. I want to do three things. I want to talk about the context. I want to say something about framing law, policy and practice, and I want to talk about ways forward. I suppose the overarching theme today is the sense that what Brexit has done is that it has accelerated a discussion about the constitutional future of the island that we're on. And that's going to be the main focus of the discussion today, bearing in mind there are many other conversations to be had. So first of all, I want to say something about Brexit. I want to say something about context. Gives the game away, I suppose, and context. And in thinking about context, I'm obviously aware that we could have a discussion for the rest of the week on that. So I want to hone in on a few things that I think are relevant. Obviously the big B word, or U word, actually, Brexit or UK exit, or UKexit. I just find it easier to say Brexit. But really, the UK's exit from the European Union is really a framing context for this discussion. What do we know? We know that in 2016, there's a UK-wide vote to leave the European Union, in which two constituent parts of the UK voted to remain in the context of a UK-wide vote to leave. We know that that 2016 vote took place in the context of a much more pluralistic UK than would have been the case if that discussion had happened in the 80s or early 90s. See, a number of people in the room very familiar with constitutional law and constitutionalism. But by the time 2016 came along, we are having this conversation in the context of a much more pluralistic UK that was increasingly decentralised and differentiated, primarily but not exclusively in relation to, for example, the devolved arrangements. We know that the region we're in here, Northern Ireland, the North, the jurisdiction, whatever, voted to remain. And we know that that outcome and the extent of that outcome has occurred in subsequent elections. We know that the power-sharing executive collapsed in January 2017 for a range of reasons, and I think it's worth looking back again at Martin McGuinness's resignation letter to see the range of reasons that were included there. We know that Brexit has had a destabilising impact on the UK. Almost every institution of the British Constitution has been engaged in the tussles unfolded around Brexit. The Crown, Parliament, the Executive, courts, civil servants, the devolved arrangements, or those that are currently functioning, have all been involved in that discussion. The Belfast Good Friday Agreement, very much in our minds today as we're taking in the outcome of the D'Souza case that people are talking about and is around in discussion today. The Belfast Good Friday Agreement. We know that the EU is textually present in the document. It is textually present in the document. We know that membership and common membership of the European Union was a background working assumption of the process. Remember, both states were in the European Union together, and both states stuck quite close together to each other in their membership of the European Union, with obvious differences as well. For example, in areas like immigration and asylum, where both states work very closely to be protective of the common travel area. We know that Brexit creates an external border of the European Union on the island of Ireland, with one part of the island leaving the EU, another part remaining in the EU. Now, there's been a lot of talk in this conversation about the trade and economic impact of that, about the invisibility of the border on the island, about the symbolic and other impact of what for many will be seen as the repartition of the island. But I think what's been missed in some of that is the conceptual devastation of Brexit for some of the key concepts at the heart of the agreement. Concepts like parity of esteem, like mutual respect, like equal treatment for British and Irish citizens. Brexit creates big, big challenges conceptually for the agreement. Why? Because at the far end of Brexit, we will be in a position where Irish citizenship matches on to EU citizenship, albeit outside of the European Union, and the residual and other rights and entitlements that go with that. But British citizenship will fall into an entirely new, and depending on what happens, category. And I think it's been underexplored in the discussion so far, the extent to which Brexit itself fundamentally leaves a scar down the middle of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement that will be hard to address at that conceptual level. The agreement itself represents many things, and at the moment one of the fascinating things about the agreement is the scale of interpretive struggle over its terms and meanings, with everybody claiming to have the true meaning of the agreement, and everybody around Europe and in these islands claiming to endorse and love the Good Friday Agreement. I just want to draw out a few things here. If the constitutional aspirations at the heart of the Good Friday Agreement are equally legitimate, in other words, if it is equally legitimate to pursue the goal of a united kingdom and continuing membership of that, and Irish reunification, and if those are both treated on an equal basis, as at the core of a constitutional compromise, at the heart of that agreement, then it seems to me perfectly justifiable and legitimate in the context of the Brexit conversation to see the agreement mechanism of reunification of the island as a remain return option in the context of the wider Brexit discussion. Now, helpfully, in April 2017, the European Council confirmed that the whole territory of the island of Ireland would be within the European Union in the context of a vote for unity. And it seems to me that it would be remarkable, actually, it would be remarkable in the context of forced removal from the European Union, the external border that will emerge on the island of Ireland, if that aspect of the Good Friday Belfast Agreement wasn't featuring in the current discussion as a rational argument about one of a number of ways forward. So in terms of that particular conversation about how this island is shared in the future, I think what's staggering is the scale of reflection, debate and dialogue that is ongoing in spite of what I think a lot of pressure not to have that conversation now. I think there's a real sense in which there's a growing and evolving civic and other dialogue here and on this island on that particular question. We see that in relation to the scale of international attention on the issue. We see that in these islands, and particularly in this region, in the scale of civic engagement with the issue. Just in this report, we try to capture and do a snapshot of the state of the current unity conversation. And what's really quite staggering, I think, on the island is that almost every major public figure and commentator on this island in the last 12 months has felt the need to address the subject of Irish reunification in the context of Brexit. I make no comment on that either way, and sometimes that's for or against, sceptical, cautious, but the fact that that is happening seems striking. There are a number of civic movements that have emerged with this issue at the heart of their work and campaigning. And what we've also seen recently, which I think is instructive and interesting, are universities around these islands beginning to work on this issue as well. We see a recent initiative from UCL in London involving a number of universities. We've seen, for example, the Constitutional Futures Initiative being led from UCD, again involving a number of academics and others. And in this report, we list simply the number of people at the moment, particularly in the university context and elsewhere, who are working on it. So there's a sense when thinking about context that this is a discussion that has traction and momentum, that is evolving and growing. Growing in a way, I think, that is trying to be, to borrow Michel Barnier's phrase that didn't necessarily work out on the backstop, but a de-dramatised discussion, a normalised discussion, a mainstream conversation about a core aspect of the Belfast Agreement that should surprise nobody in relation to the Brexit conversation. But just to end in terms of context, what's striking is this, and I just put it out there for discussion. There's been distinctive and parallel tracks in relation to some of this. EU-UK negotiation around the withdrawal agreement and the protocol has stressed and emphasised the importance of a deconstitutionalised conversation, a conversation around conservation and preservation of the technical dimensions of what happens on these islands now. And when you look at that strand of the discussion, there's been a very, very strong emphasis on deconstitutionalising the discussion around the protocol, the backstop. Running in parallel, I think, with a more explicitly constitutionalised discussion. And in thinking about the context, I think, as a question, there's something interesting going on there in relation to people talking past each other, in relation to issues of strategy and tactics around conversation. But I think it's very, very striking that there's been a very, very strong attempt, particularly in the Brexit negotiations, to deconstitutionalise that conversation as about essentially the technical components of preserving the agreement, avoiding a hard border, and ensuring all island cooperation, going alongside what is a more constitutionalized discussion. So second, I just want to say something about framing law, policy, and practice. It seems relevant today, and I don't need to tell many people in this room some of this, but we have the Good Friday Belfast Agreement. And when we talk about the agreement, I think we have to differentiate the multi-party agreement and the bilateral legal components of that. We're essentially talking about a document that is a political agreement between political parties, but also an international bilateral treaty between Britain and Ireland, British-Irish Agreement. So the agreement is reflected in international law, it's reflected in domestic law in both states. International law, the British-Irish Agreement, in the Irish Constitution, Articles 2 and 3, in the Northern Ireland Act 1998, Section 1, Schedule 1. The provision specifically relating to the debate on the constitutional future. And those provisions essentially around testing the principle of consent and the right to self-determination have found their way into domestic law recognised in international law. So what we're, I think, on a trajectory towards are concurrent referendums or referenda. I'm going to say referendums, right? I did Latin level rights when you know it. Referendums. Concurrent referendums on the island of Ireland, North and South. On which there will be a binding obligation on both governments in the event of a vote for Irish reunification to take forward the outcome. On the British end of that, I think, one of the things that will be intriguing to watch and what we're finding in the Brexit negotiations is that even if you get an outcome in favour of Irish reunification in a referendum, the next step of taking anything through the Westminster Parliament is not necessarily straight forward, and there'll be all sorts of questions that arise around it. The agreement also contains an obligation of rigorous impartiality and birthright provisions around British-Irish citizenship and identity that we're finding, I think, in recent weeks and months are not effectively legislated for, particularly in British law, policy and practice. Much of this you know already, but I think the point I want to make in terms of framing is the Belfast Good Friday Agreement will both frame the process itself, it will frame the substance of what emerges, and it will also frame the next steps for that process as well. For example, to draw out one small point in relation to the discussion today, the birthright obligation, the right to be British or Irish or both, is clearly intended in the agreement to be a continuing obligation, legal obligation, that will persist into the future, whatever the constitutional status of this region itself. And that will have important implications, for example, for British citizens in any future scenario. So it's a discussion and a constitutional conversation that is very much framed by the Good Friday Agreement. The European Union, as this report tries to show, will also have a role, I think, in the future, particularly in a post-Brexit environment. Because, first of all, in the April 2017 European Council statement, they have clearly affirmed the fact that the entire territory will be in the European Union. In other words, there will be no need. Ireland won't be a new state. It won't need to accede to the European Union. The entire territory will be the territory of an EU member state. But I think what we try to point out in Brussels next week, it's time for the other institutions of the European Union to put flesh on the bones of the promise from April 2017. In the same spirit that many people are talking about the Irish government doing preparatory and preparation work now, that as we head and move, I think, towards referendums on this island in the years ahead, they'll not simply be questions for the British government. They'll not simply be questions for the Irish government. There'll be questions that the European Union will have to address, because we're essentially talking about the possibility of a region in a post-Brexit context returning to the European Union. And I think what we try to outline in this report is why we think the EU will have a role in that, and there are issues that will have an impact on EU member states and EU institutions that will have to be addressed. In terms of the process itself, I think what's striking about the agreement is the role of the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland in triggering the process. That's laid out in the Northern Ireland Act 1998. Again, many people will know, large amount of discretion for the Secretary of State in relation to shading that in framing that process, shading into duty, where it's likely that people would vote for Irish unity. There's been litigation on that here that has clarified aspects of that process, but it's a process that gives the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland considerable discretion. Why does it shade into duty? Well, think about it. Let me put it rather starkly. If compelling evidence begins to emerge that a majority of people in this region are no longer content with the current constitutional arrangements, then you're beginning to enter the territory of the de facto illegitimacy of current membership of the UK. And I put it that starkly, as a rationale for the reason why such a vote would need to take place. So the second point is just to underline then the extent to which the Belfast Good Friday Agreement and its provisions will frame the conversation to come. It won't answer all the questions about that. There will, both states have their own processes, which are very different. They're both constitutionally very different for taking this forward. There'll be difficult questions, for example, in this region about who gets to vote in the referendum here. Will the Scottish approach, that more generous approach adopted in Scotland, will that be followed? What will the question be? What will the questions be in relation to these things that will have to be thought through, worked out in the time ahead? So the third thing I just want to raise in terms of ways forward and questions. So the premise, what I'm saying today, is that I think we're in the midst of an evolving constitutional conversation on this island about the constitutional future that has been, I'm trying to use another word than accelerated, but speeded up, or brought into focus as a result of the destabilising elements of Brexit, that makes that conversation about how we share the island in the time ahead a different conversation. Because return or remain to the European Union becomes a component of it. Either way, you may feel that's a good thing, a bad thing, but it just is a fact. And the European Union, as well as its member states, will have an interest in that conversation. Because if you want to strip away the emotion, it clearly ticks a number of the objectives in terms of the long-term objectives in relation to this island. And unlike other examples, because people immediately go, well, what about Spain? This is clearly constitutionally provided for in the constitutional internal order of both states. There's no way this is a solo run by either Ireland or Britain. This is clearly an internationally legally endorsed, domestically legislated, constitutional process entirely within the internal constitutional legal order of both states. So in terms of ways forward, I just want to put a number of points out there for discussion. I think that, so one thing you'll hear is people will say, on either side of that debate. You're for the union with the UK, you're for United Ireland. Where's your 800-page document with all your propositions about healthcare, social security, employment, pensions? Where is all that? Or I won't talk to you without it. I think one of the things we need to think about in framing this, in the sense of normalising, de-dramatising and mainstreaming the discussion, is that this is essentially an invitation to a conversation about constitutional futures and futures, plural and pluralist. So it's an invitation to join a conversation in which I know buzzwords like co-authorship and co-design are part of the discussion. And if you're having a genuine conversation about the constitutional future, albeit one framed by important and significant guarantees internationally, domestically, and in the agreement, if you're serious about co-authoring something or co-designing something, you may turn up with a draft, you may turn up with ideas, but what you don't turn up with is a 900-page, 800-page document saying, there you go, that's your future. And I think that's an important framing context for where we're going on this island. I think the conversation is already organically evolving and developing, and I'm getting myself into increasing trouble, some of the things I say around this, I think. But look, like a number of people in the room have been involved over the years in civic society activism around human rights and equality and other things. If you had to ask the permission of governments, if you had to wait for governments to do stuff, you'd have to wait a long time. Governments will catch up. Governments and others, they will catch up, they will overtake you, they will take your process over, and they'll claim it was their idea in the first place. And that's been the experience here. I think that where this comes from is courageous civic society leadership, and I think universities, academics and others have a role in that. And governments will catch up. They'll get there and catch up. So there's a sense in which this conversation is evolving organically, and it's already happening. So we're not talking about something that has ended, we're talking about something that is developing. The role of universities and others in this discussion, and looking to the discussion around Brexit, is to be clear that the discussion needs to be evidence-based and factual. I would say that one of the principal obstacles to having this conversation is a rather emotional argument that says it's not the right time. It's not the right time to have the discussion. Or we'll have it at some other time. I don't think that's a good argument for not working on an evidence-based and factual way about propositions around the constitutional future of this island. Also, don't think it can be left to the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, whatever the Northern Ireland Act happens to say. What we don't need in this society, I think, is for the Secretary of State to emerge one day and decide there's going to be a referendum on the constitutional future next Wednesday or next month or in 6 months. And in the current wacky world of British politics, you know, who knows where we could end up with some of this. So I think in thinking about ways forward, it needs to be framed decisively by a British-Irish framework following extensive civic and political dialogue and engagement within which universities like Queen's should have a central role. Leadership for this process will have to come, I think, from both governments working together. Obviously, at the moment, perhaps not the best time to be making that suggestion, but in the longer term, I think that word needs to come. I think the British-Irish Intergovernmental Conference is the ideal forum for both governments in a number of senses. One, I think there's a desperate need at the moment for the British-Irish Intergovernmental Conference to become a much more robust institution that is meeting and working on a much more regular basis. a joint declaration or joint statement from the Intergovernmental Conference to frame and answer some of the outlying questions that we've talked about. In Ireland, a minister or ministry specifically tasked with the question of Irish reunification, to work on the planning and preparation that everybody talks about, but so few people are actually doing in practice right now. We need an all-Ireland civic and citizens' assembly on the constitutional future to be established that will report to an Oireachtas committee that will set out and frame the options and proposals and propositions. As only some of the work that needs to be done in relation to taking this forward, so that when these referendums do come, and I think we are on a trajectory for them to take place, that whether you're arguing for the continuation of the UK in its current arrangements, or you're arguing for Irish reunification, that the propositions made are factual, evidence-based, accurate propositions about what is being proposed, and that reassurances are needed in relation particularly to where constitutional change is being suggested. Now, thus far in the discussion, I think, there's been a tendency to say those proposing constitutional change by Irish reunification bear the primary responsibility for populating the argument in that debate. And I think there's no doubt that there's a responsibility where you're proposing significant constitutional change on this island, that you have a well-developed, evidence-based, factual case. But I think the challenge at the moment is that there's also a requirement on those who want the current constitutional arrangements to persist into the future, to work on propositions and proposals and arguments as to why people in this region might want to remain in the United Kingdom in the years ahead in the context of the things I've discussed today. And I think there are genuine questions in the context of what I'm suggesting here about how that would be framed, how that would be done, and how that would be taken forward in a way that makes sure, again, like the other side of the argument, that that is factual, evidence-based. I think what we don't need in this society is a fear-filled, anxiety-ridden, myth-replete discussion about the nature of the UK and its future, or the nature of Ireland and its future. We need evidence, facts about the proposition, so that we're informed and prepared for referendums that I think are coming north and south on this island that have been radically accelerated by the process of Brexit. In that sense, I think, deal, no deal, the nature of Brexit itself propels this conversation, whatever form Brexit takes. Simply because whatever form of agreement is reached, this region will be outside of the European Union, looking to another bit of the island that will be in the European Union. Let me be absolutely clear about this. The European Union has and will have a strategical and tactical imperative of making sure that Ireland succeeds, if only to prove the Brexiteers wrong. And I think the nature of that, its implications for this island over the next years and decades, are underexplored. To put it, you all, Europe, all politics people, you know this better than me. The European Union, by the nature of the process and its institutions, will have a strategic imperative to be able to show that the Irish decision to remain in the European Union was the right call. In other words, the grass, when we look south on this island, will look greener. And over the longer term, the proposition that simply that looks like the better bet for people here may become a compelling proposition or may not become a compelling proposition depending on what happens in the years ahead. But I think that's a considerable element to that discussion. So I think Brexit brings novel components to a constitutional process that was already there in the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. It's at the heart of its constitutional compromise. But what we're finding in the recent weeks and months and years, to be candid, is that many of the core concepts of the agreement are not well understood or have not been sufficiently carried forward into law, policy and practice in ways that they might have been. And I simply really state today, and you can tell me to go and whatever and I'm wrong, right? Or chuck me out the window there or something, I don't know, is that my own sense is that Brexit has accelerated that discussion, that that's reasonable, understandable, would be remarkable if it didn't. That I think we should welcome and embrace the constitutional development aspects of that discussion rather than try and run away from it, Ryan, rather than try and pretend, rather than try and talk about widgets and tariffs and economics, that we recognise that this is core to the agreement that everyone endorses and that we should be able to talk about it, reflect on it, think about it and discuss it. So I think we're heading towards these things in the years ahead. Just to end then, you've heard enough from me. What I've tried to do today, hopefully relatively coherently, is try to say something about context, where we are now. Second, say something about the framing of that context legally, of which there's much more could be said. And finally, what I've tried to do is think about some ways forward in the spirit of dialogue, discussion, debate, conversation, totally open to being totally wrong, this, that, whatever. So, two things, I think, in response to that. Like, I just speak personally about some of this. I've been personally quite struck by the implications of raising this in this society this year, because I'm conscious that it's not always a welcome conversation, and that's fine, right? Public debate is public debate. But two things. Having watched what's unfolded in Brexit and what it has done to these islands and the region that we are in, is that the argument that, going back years really in Britain, that when you're facing these big constitutional questions, that the response is, it's not the right time, or bury our heads in the sand, or we can't talk about that, or it's divisive, or it's unhelpful to talk about it, doesn't seem to me to be a very university, scholarly, academic type response to these sorts of questions. I think our role really in this is to be the responsible people in the room in these discussions, and I want to flip over some uses of responsible in that context. My own view increasingly is, and look, like other people raising this at the moment, I've had the reaction at times that this is not helpful, it's divisive, it's dangerous. I just don't, I understand, but I don't agree. I think in the context where we may be, through events, propelled into something that is at the core of the agreement, the responsible thing to do is to plan, prepare, to talk about it with each other, and try and manage in a responsible way the choice that is already there in the agreement that Brexit really accelerates. The final point will be, again, and you may definitely tell me I'm wrong on this, It's just a hunch on which I could be completely. I feel, and it's not just true of universities, it's true generally, that on this island now, we don't talk to each other enough now on the island. Forget about the future. Forget about in the here and now on this island, people don't talk to each other enough. There's a sort of partition of the mind. There's myths. Our local media seems never to report what's happening on the south of the island. We don't know each other well enough now. We don't know what's happening in each other's societies on this island now. So the argument I would make is I think we'll be a better place and the island will be a healthier place for having had the conversation. If it's a conversation based on planning, preparation, facts, evidence, and not fear and anxiety. And on all sides of that argument, I think we can rightly expect that all sides of the argument need to put forward convincing propositions about what it means to select either of those options in referendums that I think are coming perhaps as soon as the next 5 years. Okay, so that's me done. Thank you very much.
So Colin, thank you for an extremely interesting and I would say provocative paper. I hope what you intended. And I'll now open this to the audience where I'm sure you will have some questions. Liam, and can people identify themselves, please?
Liam Kennedy. I'm sorry I missed the beginning of the talk. My apologies. There was a reference to a report. Is that a commissioned report? Commissioned by whom?
It's a GUI NGL in the European Parliament.
And who are in that group?
So would you like to read the report first? Or?
Well, no, I think in the interest of that oft-repeated word conversation, you might enlighten us.
Well, there's a grouping in the European Parliament called the European United Left and Nordic Green Left, European Parliamentary Group. It's available on QPOL, free of charge. Please download it and read it. It was commissioned with myself and a barrister called Mark Bassett, so it's very much a co-authored piece as well. So very much welcome your comments on it.
Yeah, I'm aware of some of the members of that group. Remind me, is Sinn Féin a member?
Yep,
of that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Any other questions, please? Adrian, yeah. Again, identify yourself.
Adrian Gilkey from sort of politics emeritus. What strikes me is that the impetus behind this change is almost entirely externally driven. I mean, if you go back to 2012, you had, I mean, Peter Robinson saying, you know, the siege is lifted, basically because at that point, the likelihood of any referendum being in favour of the United Ireland seemed completely remote. And conditions inside Northern Ireland haven't changed since then. What has changed is entirely the external context. So I just wondered how you see the external. The external context can go in all kinds of directions. And I just wondered if you saw how you saw that playing, or whether you think that that's just not, doesn't matter, as it were. That this is externally driven doesn't really affect the basic argument you're making.
Do you want me to?
Yeah, go ahead.
Liam, I wasn't sure there was a question in that, but was there?
Well, that's why I moved as well.
Yeah, okay. So Adrian's point, that's why I suppose I emphasised a bit at the end about the Brexit makes it a difference or strategic conversation.
because we're now in a sort of Europe-wide, we're at the centre of a Europe-wide strategic tussle, right? And that's, you know, why I mentioned that. In the sense the EU has a strategic to make the decision around, it needs, Ireland needs to work, right, in the context of that conversation in an argument with the Brexiteers that their model doesn't work, right? I think, so that changes, I think, the external dynamic. Now, that can go both ways. Maybe the UK will become, you know, maybe the EU will fall apart. We all know that the European Union at the moment is wrought with internal battles and struggles over its own direction too. But I think that the Brexit conversation, you know, they're both in together. It was a sort of air that you breathe behind some of the, even the concepts in the agreement. And now it becomes a fracture line on the island. But I think that it then stops being just a British-Irish discussion, because the EU will have an interest. It is said that the North will return to the EU, and it will have an impact on the Eurozone, you know, impact on member states afterwards. So the EU now has an interest, and I think what's interesting about that, so people immediately, when you talk to them, say, but, you know, the EU is not going to touch anything that looks like self-determination, and it's very... But what's different about the British-Irish context is that the agreement provisions are an intrinsic part of the internal constitutional order of both states. They're not a rogue bit of the going off in one direction. So, and the entire negotiations are populated with this phrase, the Good Friday Agreement, in all its parts. So it's just to underline the sense in which this will continue to be not just a British-Irish, but an EU-Irish-British conversation in the years ahead, I think. Does that?
Yeah, that's partly answers my, yeah. Colin, there's another angle that I can think of in this, which is that, I mean, the EU was premised on the idea of developing interdependence between states, and all the sort of cross-borderism that the EU engages in many countries is designed on the basis that you remove border disputes and conflicts over boundaries by kind of creating greater economic dependence between, like, all the money that's gone, the EU money that's gone on the EU peace model into kind of the borders here. I mean, it's sort of slightly paradoxical that the EU finds itself in a position where to promote its project it needs to change borders when the EU model of peacemaking on the whole has been to operate within the borders that they've been given, as it were, and to try and kind of resolve issues across borders by encouraging cross-border activity. I mean, it seems slightly paradoxical anyway.
But I think there's a sense in which that's why what will emerge here is some form of hybrid special arrangement in order to, that will continue to attract EU support in the longer term. And I don't think the EU will touch anything, but it will be clearly for the people of this island to determine their future. But I think the imperative, which I may be wrong on, is that the imperative to make the Brexiteer choice look like the wrong choice. And I think that has implications for how this region evolves and the decisions that may eventually be made and the propositions that may be made in the future. Now, I may be completely wrong. Brexit may be an amazing success. The UK may and the EU may fall apart. But I think it just creates a new dynamic. Also, what was clear, we've been out in Brussels a few times, the European Union gets this stuff. This is what it does, right? It does accession. It does all sorts of funny hybrid things all over Europe and supports it. So there's a sense in which it's no longer going to return ever, I think, to just a simple bilateral. There will always be a European interest in what emerges, I think, on this island. I think, you know, I would say in relation to some of this, you know, also in a good way, you know, people talk about, let's say there is a vote for reunification on the island, the economic implications of that. I think some of that is rather naive. I think any transition on this island will be a managed transition over time, maybe over a number of years, where the European Union and also international partners will be involved in managing the implications of that, including the economic and financial dimensions as well. So,
Sean, you want to ask questions?
Yeah. Sean Connery, so a super underrated historian. I was really nervous analysis. I'm really glad to hear it. But what bothered me was you were talking at two different levels. You were talking about what you call a conversation, sort of open-ended discussion, open-ended discussion of the future. And you were talking about the Good Friday Agreement and things that are written into law and constitutional law and the ways in which Brexit makes those two problematic. Now, it seemed to me that hanging in the background was the implication that one influenced the other, that the legal troubles being thrown by Brexit were going to tilt the conversation more in the direction of unification. And that's why I'm sceptical, because you've got to remember, attitudes to the Good Friday Agreement are totally asymmetrical. Nationalists see them as something to be cherished, enshrined to aspirations. Unionists see it as the price they paid for an end to violence. And when it was passed, they were told that this was copper fastening, no lines placed within the UK. So if you now start to say to most committed unionists that the Good Friday Agreement is tilting your conversation towards unification, as far as they're concerned, the Good Friday Agreement, in the classic phrase, is no longer fit for purpose.
I think that one of the things about the title is its futures, and I think the only way to engage people, I think, ultimately on this and reflect it for is if that is plural and pluralist opening invitation to, so that it's not tilting towards one particular outcome, even if the strategic drivers may make that a more attractive proposition or not, that's for other people to decide. I just think factually that is a plausible argument but may not be right. It has to be futures, it has to be plural and pluralist. It has to be an invitation to conversation where the outcome is not predetermined, whatever the particular preferences of participants in it. And I think that's my guess would be that is the only way you will get unionists to participate in a conversation.